and maybe even see how it might apply to their community.
Yeah, for sure. So people can check out siembranc.org. And then for people who want to see the playbook and figure out outside of North Carolina how to get involved, you can go to defendandrecruit.org.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest has been Nikki Marin Baena. She is Siembra NC's co-founder and co-director. And I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
Hello, I'm Scott King.
And I'm Joe Tursty. We host the KBOO podcast, the King Tursty Music Hour. Every month, we upload a new show to our KBOO website. We currently have over 80 shows available for you to listen and enjoy.
Each of our shows is based on a different theme. Enjoy great music, as well as our discussion of the songs and artists. Our show is rock, soul, and blues-based, but you might hear anything, including country, jazz, and classical.
The easiest way to find us is to simply enter King Tursty Music Hour into your web browser and select it with the KBOO FM extension. That's King, K-I-N-G, Tursty, T-U-R-S-I, Music Hour.
While you're there, check out our wide variety of shows. We've got shows on social issues, musical themes, people, the holidays, and so much more.
That's the King Tursty Music Hour on KBOO. Portland, Oregon.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, Once Upon a Time with Consuelo.
Oh, I could hide neath the wing of the bluebird as she sings. The 6 o'clock alarm never ring, but it rings and I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. My shaven razor's cold and it sings.
Hi, hi. Good evening to everybody. This is Consuelo, and this is Once Upon a Time, Friday 13th. So be aware. And here we are with a wonderful guest, as every other Friday. This time her name is Rebecca. And before she will introduce herself, I want to remind you that you can call and ask her question and comments, 503-231-8187. And at the same time, as every other Friday, I encourage you to become a member and to keep collaborating with our station. We do need your contribution, and also we are looking for more volunteer people, so this way we can keep doing what we do best: communication, education, information, and a lot of fun. And today I am very honored to introduce to you this wonderful woman. You may say every Friday, I said almost the same. Yeah, because I am so lucky. I people that come to my show, or to our show, most of all the time are wonderful women, wonderful men, wonderful artists. And that is what make this show viable. Okay. Hi.
Hi.
So go ahead, introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Rebecca Knuth, and I'm a retiree full-time writer, and I just had a book come out. It was at a wonderful opening at Annie Bloom's bookshop. The book is called London Sojourn, and Rewriting Life After Retirement. And it was a memoir of 2 years that I spent in London after I retired. I was a professor at the University of Hawaii for 18 years, but I decided that I needed something new, and so retirement would be a period of reinvention. And I wanted to go to this place I loved above all places, a place that just captured my imagination from the time I was a child, and that was London. So I managed to do it with a 2-year student visa, and I took a class in creative nonfiction. And creative nonfiction is, it's still the facts, it's still fiction, but it's writing more popularly. And that's what I wanted to do because I was tired of writing like an academic. I had been an expert and wrote 2 books on the violent destruction of books and libraries in modern times. So case studies of things like the Nazis, Tibet, Chinese Cultural Revolution, Serbia, all these different places all around the world where the regimes would actually go out after books.
Can I interrupt you?
Sure.
Yeah, when I read that part in your book, and I thought about Chile. So no long time ago, only a few years, 50 years more or less, that happened in Chile too. And when they start burning the books in the front of the government place, it was the beginning. And like you mentioned in your book, that quote that said that when you start burning books, then you end burning human.
Yes.
And that is exactly what happened in Chile. So we don't have to go so far in history, because this is happening now and in many places in the world. Okay.
It is, and I was really immersed in it when I was at the University of Hawaii and writing those books. But I was frustrated because academics don't write the kind of material, for the most part, that is translatable to the normal reader or the intelligent reader who wants to have access to this kind of information. So I went to London, and the idea was that I was going to satisfy my love of England. I was going to take this 2-year writing course and learn to create narratives where the facts were presented as stories or as interesting. And so that's what I did. I did many other things. I also took a street guiding course and worked on a project for my writing course, which involved women writers. And so I went all over. I took every advantage of leading this whole different lifestyle. I call it a nonfiction life.
Yeah. I think it was a wonderful experience. I encourage you to look for the book and we will talk about it because, like I said, she is also another Renaissance woman, because she took advantage of that time in London quite well, not only studying, writing, and walking a lot, taking buses, taking the metro, and going to museums and visiting so many nice places. So if you like London or you haven't been in London, I will strongly recommend that you buy this book, because it will give you a complete different size or perspective of London. That is what happened to me. I have been in London 3 times, but I cannot say that I know London quite well, because I don't. But after reading the book, I thought, oh, I have to go to London, really. It's the only way we can do it. Okay, I would like to start. You are going to read one of your passages about your mother, which is a very interesting subject and nice. So go ahead.
Okay, so just to give you a little background, one of the things I had to deal with in London was not only reinventing myself as a writer, but sort of figuring out who I was as a person, especially as a woman. And any woman who wants to figure out who they are has to figure out their relationship with their mother. So this is what this passage is about. My mother is still alive, but her presence is flickering, and here in London, I am sorting through how our relationship affected my development. I'm working through my identification with her, how her conformity feeds my commitment to living a full life and being a writer, and why separation is both necessary and hard. The writer Virginia Woolf helps me, as does South African-born Lyndall Gordon. Gordon's book, Divided Lives, Dreams of a Master and a Daughter, is both her memoir and a biography of her mother. She writes about women's lives and the complex, demanding role of being a daughter and needing to separate. Her mother abandoned her own literary aspirations, while Lyndall chose an alternate path and sifted through issues such as wanting a life of the mind, a life outside of domesticity and equal partnership with her husband. In Divided Lives, she explores the lack of communication between her mother, who conformed to social norms, and Lyndall, who refused to live by what she saw as obsolete gender-based systems of rules. Women in pursuit of achievement and autonomy often define themselves against their mothers. Margaret Forster, a novelist, the author of Georgie Girl, and a biographer with a 30-year career, married a celebrated British journalist and author, Hunter Davies, but didn't live in his shadow. In the book Hidden Lives, a Family Memoir, which came out in 1996, she writes about her mother, aunts, and grandmother, working-class women from Carlisle, England, and the changing nature of domestic life and feminine aspirations. When her mother, an intelligent woman, married and gave up a good job as a secretary, a marriage ban was prevalent, and even the law, until the 1960s and 70s. So she lost control of her life. She lived a half-life full of depression and deprivation. In Hidden Lives, the actions and reactions lack overt drama, but nevertheless drive the trajectory of each woman's life. Characters choose. They change or reap the negative consequences. In Marrying, Margaret's mother gave up autonomy, or perhaps it would be more correct to say that she thereafter channeled what autonomy she had into narrow, circumscribed byways. Hidden Lives captures the tension that arises when daughters reject their mother's choices. Margaret's words feel uncannily like truth. Liberation from one's mother is tough because of the deep bonds laid down in childhood. My choice has led to a profession and identity, academia, denied to my mother, although she mostly supported it for me. I arrived in London still tethered to her emotionally, lingering as well with the rules of womanliness absorbed from my parents' children's books, which are innately conservative, biographies and novels that presented idealized portraits of women serving, sacrificing, conforming, and deferring to authority. Thoughts on the lives of the women I'm writing about have become all mixed up with thoughts about my life. cautionary maxims I was raised on, like be a good girl, respect authority, and family knows best, jostle with memories of seizing semi-autonomy as an academic and experiments with possessing my own life and dreams. Now, in 2016, as I'm writing the book, I probe incidents from my past for their lessons, sexual, professional, utilitarian. Virginia Woolf helps me reckon with my parents and calculate the effects of remnants of 19th century beliefs on appropriate femininity that linger within me, where distancing myself from my mother feels like transgression. Within my subjects and myself, there is a tension between the need to create and the mandate of conforming and serving. Being oneself without apology is difficult. The pressure on women to defer dreams and become full-time caretakers is such that it's hard to defend my life in London with mom so infirm. I haven't been a self-conscious feminist. Much of my old adult life, I've operated from ignorance and shied away from feminist positions I thought were unduly aggressive, like hating men and being demanding. The stereotype of feminist is strident. Now I'm questioning the need for socialized reticence. In learning about the silencing of women over the last 200 years, I'm discovering that vulnerability has been used against women, especially when women's dependence upon men is justified by their supposed physical and intellectual inferiority. Women are struggling to transform vulnerability into a strength, a tool against silence. I'm starting to see my story as that of a shy girl who was enmeshed in a conservative American family. My task as a young woman was to let go of the illusions and norms fostered by my family and sanitize fictional worlds where women's stories ended with marriage. To loosen the grip of constrictive traditional notions of womanhood that lingered in the 1960s codes, the denial of women's sexuality, ambition, and life force, and in my case, a dream of being a writer, so tenuous that it barely existed. I've spent my entire life on this project. When my family moved from Alaska to Southern California, I was a social misfit and remained so throughout my reclusive high school years. An Englishness absorbed through books gave me hope, faith in human decency and happy endings, but the books didn't help me grow. In Georgette Heyer's mix of romance and gentle humor, little disturbed the conservative universe with its assumption about womanliness into which I was born. I was deaf to the subtexts in Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte. I might have learned about feminists had I entered college 5 years later. But I graduated from high school in 1967 and attended a small religious college for 2 years. This was a time of riots in Watts and anti-war protests in Washington, D.C., as troop levels in Vietnam climbed to 460,000. I did a semester abroad program in London in the spring and then transferred to the University of Colorado in Boulder in the fall of 1969. My parents didn't realize that it was the Berkeley of the West. I wasn't prepared for the counterculture I encountered. Swept into the sexual revolution, willing but clueless, I tried to reconcile sex and romance, a difficult task in a promiscuous world. I joined the protests and was a rather careful hippie, picturesque in my vintage black velvet, but attending classes and avoiding psychedelic drugs. I remember a later conversation in which friends recalled their college days when their black radical feminist group used to stay up all night discussing women's issues. When I said that I never experienced that, maybe I went to bed too early, Sunny, who'd been a winsome Korean among the black sisters, said incredulously, "You mean you missed the entire feminist movement because you couldn't stay up late?" And then she laughed. I remember dope, smoking, fumbling sex, and war protests, but I was shy and ignorant about feminism. Only now, though writing on long-suffering women writers, am I on my way to understanding the oppressive conditions that women have experienced.
Okay, this is a very interesting part. And Jung spoke about individuation. So this is the first thing that you have to do, that you individuate from your parents. And when you are an adult, that means that you become a different person, your own person. But I wonder why it took you so long to arrive to that point where you are writing this part. What was also intriguing you and give you pain and discomfort, because you felt almost that you were a traitor if you get apart from your mother, because you were already physical apart, so that helped. Yeah. You were in Hawaii first, and Hawaii, and then you were in London. So you look for those places, maybe in purpose, to be away, but at the same time, you were not away. It was still in you.
It was different separating from my father and from my mother. My father died.
We're talking about your mother.
Yeah, and so then I was on a different sort of journey. I had the permission, and my mother actually gave me permission, and I started taking risks. And I was developing. I was developing as a woman, as a person.
Yeah.
I was getting much tougher, and I was finding my bliss, which was actually research and writing. And I became an assistant professor, associate professor, full professor.
But these are the things that you did, not who you were. There are two different things. You are like a masculine mind. Men describe themselves for what they do. No, I am not looking for that. I know all the things that you have done. But almost a chapter that you read is not about all the things that you have done. Is about that you have a conflict with your mother and that you were trying to look for who you were or you at the time. So the question remains, why it took you so long when you knew all the things that you have done? So still was something there that was missing perhaps, or something that you were not accepting all the wonderful thing that you have done in your life perhaps.
I think that's very true. I mean, I had accomplished a lot.
Of course.
But I still was very hooked emotionally to my mother.
Yeah, that is what I want to go.
Yes, and that's a difficult one. And I think many women are, and actually many women never totally unhook. And that makes it difficult.
Perhaps you were so hooked, as you said, because you were expecting from her some kind of blessing to tell you, I am not only proud, but I am very happy who you became.
I think she was
happy. I have the feeling in the book that she was your fan. She admired you, and she was the one who pushed you in some way to become who you are now.
I think the critical time came when she became in a nursing home.
I agree.
And so when she became in a nursing home, you hook into the caretaking role, and it's a sort of different relationship. And I had to come to terms with the fact that I had to go on with my life, and that I couldn't put it all on a back burner to be a caretaker. And that was hard emotionally to accept, because that is such an important role for women.
Yeah, the caretaker. Especially that you were very close to her during all your childhood and teenager year, you were very close. So it's like you felt not obligated, but you felt responsible, especially that your brother was taking a lot of the role. And he was going and taking care of her in some way or another. At least he was more with her because you were in another place. And it is always a conflict between the relationship, like you said, between mothers and daughters. So maybe it would have been better if you have a daughter instead of a son. Maybe that will have helped you also to understand better how the relation goes, and it's not easy. Perhaps, like you said, because it's so close, I mean, but it's also close between boys and mother sometimes. But how you feel now after she passed? How did you feel?
It's horrible to say, but her life had diminished and diminished, and I think it's a form of cruelty the way we can't keep older people alive when they can't. When in her case, she couldn't see, she couldn't hear. You know, her mind was wandering. Sometimes she felt pain. I felt relief, but I also felt happy with my choice about going to London, because that was balanced by the fact that I was still coming back three or four times a year throughout the time I was in London. But it gave my brother a chance to have a relationship with her that he had never had. And so I realized that in a way, my just sort of stepping away, and I don't mean to make that sound like a rationalization, but it was a good byproduct of the pain of separation that he then could have more connection.
Yeah, but what's good for you? You are here. He's not here. I am interested in you. What's good for you? You feel that was very good for you, that you did the right thing? You cannot change the past, I know. But I want to know if you came into peace with the whole situation.
I really did, and
that is what I want to hear.
Part of that was pursuing these women writers, which I did, and wrote a book as part of my class project in London. It's called Emily Dickinson Had to Have Curls. It was about the masks of femininity, and when I wrote that book, I had to look at these authors as women and look at the notions of femininity and how it played out in their lives. And it was very fascinating, because then I related it to my life.
Great. So. That is the idea. And one of the things that you said in your book that I agree completely, that you have been a good reader of autobiography or biography or memoir or journal, all of them, I like it also. And one way we read those books, especially women writer, is because they teach us how they manage their conflict within your family and the writing.
I think that that is true after the feminists started rewriting women's biographies in history, because they showed the conflicts in the way these women handled it, and they brought nuance to their life. Before that, the biographies were just sort of almost fictionalized account of these women as women. But the I give a lot of credit to the biographers since maybe 1890, who gave us the real stories.
And also, like Virginia Woolf that you mentioned, she wrote the diary that I read it. And so we have their own word to tell us how hard is to write, how hard is to find a place where you can write, and how few people understand how lonely it is.
That's very perceptive. It's lonely in a way, but it's...
Yeah, in a way.
It's entrancing in another way, because you actually have access to all these people's minds, all these writers' minds, all the stories of what they're
writing.
Yeah,
but I am talking about when you are writing, not when you are researching. You're still an academic. You haven't taken that away from you. Still thinking as an academic. I am not thinking about the research. I am thinking about the process of writing and what we call the white page, when nothing comes and you are confronted with that empty page and you feel that maybe I will never be able to write again. That fear I have felt many times.
I'm very lucky. I don't have very much writer's block at all.
Okay.
I'm like a write-aholic. Yeah. You know, I'm just writing away. I don't, you know, it's one challenge after another. And that I consider a blessing.
Yeah, it is. And also, more than a blessing, I would say it's a skill. And that you you create that skill since you were a teenager or even earlier because you were a very good student. And so you learn that is part of your personality. And you you follow the same kind of schedule, discipline, and persistence because it's in you. And that helped you tremendously. You see all the book you have been writing and all the things that you have done. Okay, I am interested in another subject. It's about the censorship. You have a book about censorship, and I want you to tell. I think it's interesting, too.
Oh, my two academic books
yes.
were about the violent destruction of books and libraries, which is innately censorship. And what's interesting is that they were written very academically. And even my poor mother would go right off to sleep reading it. You know. And I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Okay.
And that was one of the reasons I wanted to move out of academia, because I wanted to write books people could read. Because this information is fascinating, but if it's couched in academic terms,
I agree.
In style.
That was the main reason because I didn't became an academic, because I knew that I would be frustrated too much bureaucracy, too. I have seen for the second time a movie called The Reader. I don't know if you know the book. Bernhard Schlink wrote the book, The Reader, and it's a film now, a long time ago, and it's about a person who, a woman, who doesn't know how to read.
Oh.
So I relate what I saw this film again a few weeks ago, and your censorship, because talking again about the destruction about books and library all over the world in all times and now, and how painful is to feel that still there are some people, not only women, that they don't know how to read.
When I was a professor, one of the other subjects I had was illiteracy. And literacy is so crucial to any kind of empowerment. And so I would study literacy campaigns all over the world and how different societies tried to get people up to a level of literacy. But this book is really for people who are readers who love books, because as you probably noticed, I quote all these books and authors, and I, in my embrace of London and women writers and writing, and I bring in all these different voices. And this was an exciting thing for me because I love integrating my reading into whatever I'm doing.
That is the researcher in you.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you did. And it's true that it's interesting. And sometimes I miss not to know more about you inside. Know what is around you. But also I understood, and I love it, the book. I encourage you heard me to everybody to read it, especially not only because of London, but because the way how you brought all these, some of the writer, not all of them, but many of them, to your daily life in some way or another. And that was perfect because, for example, you mentioned writer that I adore, like, for example, my dear Edith Wharton. I like her very much. Like I said, Fred and I went to her house in Massachusetts. And so we were there because I am very fan of her. And of course, Virginia Woolf and many others. But I am looking here for somebody else that I don't see. Oh, Catherine Mansfield. Oh. I am more fan of Catherine Mansfield than Virginia Woolf, for example. Because from the perspective, I don't know if you agree, I think Catherine Mansfield was more a writer in the term of creating writing, and Virginia Woolf was more a political in my opinion. Social.
Oh.
Oh, a combination. A combination. I found Manfield, especially Bliss, one of her wonderful short stories that I read very early in my life. And I was introduced by my friend. He brought that book to me and said, you need to read this short story. If you're going to write short story, this is one of the best. And so I think both are very valuable, but, you know, it's only perspective. I am not an expert in any of them. But it was very nice that you mentioned them and that you encourage also, because this is what it is. Your book encourage people to do their own research and to look for the book that you mentioned and the places that you mentioned in London.
This was what I was doing. I mean, I was trying to hunt down people, writers in their environments, and also trying to find if there was something particularly English.
Not only in their environment, not only you went to their home, you went to the cemetery.
Yes.
That is what is very interesting. I like that part too, because it's very, I go to Montparnasse, the cemetery of Montparnasse, to see Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre every time that I am in Paris.
I love cemeteries, and I actually volunteered for a whole year.
Yes, yes.
In Highgate Cemetery, which is an old Victorian cemetery.
Yeah.
And so I volunteered by running this sort of kiosk, and about 25 feet away was George Eliot's grave.
Yeah.
You know, up the hill was Virginia Woolf's parents. It was a great place to try and look at what the remnants are, how somebody is remembered. I would like to read another selection.
Sure.
And it's interesting to me that you mentioned that you were so fascinated by Edith Wharton.
Oh, yes, I like her very much. So, because in my opinion, she was a sociologist.
Absolutely. But you could make a case that a lot of writers are sociologists.
Yes, yes, that's true. As a painter, too. Yesterday, I took a training about Vermeer, who is one of my favorite, and Rembrandt, and both of them, of course.
You know, it's the eye. It's the thoughtful eye that artists really bring
to bear. And also because their perspective is in the people who are invisible and need to come up. So this way, the rest of the population know about their life.
Yes.
And how hard it is. Okay.
Okay.
What page is that?
This is page 191.
Okay. Go ahead.
Edith Wharton, née Miller, born 1862 into a prominent New York family, was schooled in social correctness, passivity, asexuality, and learned ignorance. Oops, that sounds like me. And policed by a cruel mother who set off panic attacks. Her path to authorship was torturous. A shy, self-conscious debutante, Edith married an older man with whom she was intellectually and sexually incompatible. Ambivalence about social and domestic roles led to anorexia, asthma, and chronic fatigue. But marriage allowed Wharton to separate from her mother, to travel, and to write. According to biographer Cynthia Griffin Wolfe, Wharton's struggle to become a novelist was inextricable from that of becoming a woman. Wharton's private papers allow us to see how sexuality affected her writing. The Lucy philandering bisexual journalist Morton Fullerton, her secret lover, would surface and then drop from sight. The high point of their affair was the clandestine encounter in the Charing Cross Hotel, which fronted a London railway station. In dingy room 92, 45-year-old Edith Wharton achieved orgasm and felt profoundly connected to humanity. The next day, she wrote the poem Terminus, and this is an excerpt. And lying there, hushed in your arms, as the waves of rapture receded, and far down the margin of being, we heard the low beat of the soul. I was glad as I thought of those others, the nameless, the many, who perhaps thus had lain in love for an hour on the brink of the world, secret and fast in the heart of the whirlwind of travel. Wharton, a tough-minded realist, ultimately broke off the affair with Fullerton, but she never forgot the encounter. I have drunk the wine of lies at last. I have known the thing best worth knowing. I have been warmed through and through, never to grow quite cold again till the end, she confided in her diary. She therefore wrote of love from personal experience and went on to live a brave and spirited life. On the Saturday afternoon, when I penetrate what is now the Amber Hotel Cross, Charing Cross, my inquiries about the room that Wharton and Fullerton shared are met with blank stares. The elder bellhop, here since 1970s, states that there never was or could have been a room 92. I hold my tongue. There's no staff memory or lore available, but perhaps I was naive in expecting there would be. Wharton and Fullerton wouldn't have been noticed in the early 1900s, and Terminus, the poem, and biographical revelations weren't published until much later. Another staff member, younger, opens to the possibility, explaining that because of renovation, the room numbers haven't always begun in the 200s. He leads me up an original staircase on which I imagine Wharton and Fullerton stole off to their tryst. The public rooms are beautifully renovated. But the hotel seems contextless, despite a corridor hung with framed floor plans, a menu, photographs, and newspaper clippings. The impersonal display conveys little sense of the travelers who stayed here. I suggested the boasting of Terminus, a photo, anything, perhaps in the hallway or in the dining room where Henry James supped with his friends Wharton and Fullerton before catching a train and the curtain went up for the lovers. Oh, for a little explicit Edwardianism. The hotel shares its listed facade with an entrance to the train station. I asked my guide one last question. Can you hear trains in any of the hotel rooms? He says no, not even in the basement. So much for one biographer's romantic notion that Wharton and Fullerton had made love to the noise of steam engines. The earth may have shook, but not from the trains. But wait, I thought about these lines from Terminus. Quote, as I woke and heard this calm stir of your breathing, some woman had heard as I heard the farewell shriek of the trains. Maybe steam engines were noisier than modern trains. The off-renovated Amber Hotel Charing Cross may now be sufficiently insulated from trains, cohabiting with a station without intimacy, but may not have always done so. If this affair had become public, her reputation and literary career would have been irreparably damaged, doors slammed shut and honors withheld, and yet she dared. That's a long way from the neurotic passivity of the early years of her marriage, from her conflicted performance of seemly womanliness. Charing Cross was the roll of dice in favor of self-determination and modern womanhood by a canny woman who carefully claimed her sexuality and her talent. Another brave thing Wharton did was to preserve her diaries on the affair, although her executors sequestered them in closed archives for years. Among the released papers was the stunning and graphic Beatrix Palmetto, a seriously sexy unpublished portrayal of incest between father and daughter. Where did that come from? Virginia Woolf was subject to incest by her stepbrother. Was Wharton abused as well? Wharton's biographer, Catherine Jocelyn, makes points that hit the mark with me. Because all the men in her life failed to provide her with a viable, traditional way of being a woman, Edith had the time and independence to forge a creative and fulfilling life. Jocelyn quotes feminist Caroline Heilbronn. It is a perhaps only in old age, certainly past 50, that women can stop being female impersonators, can grasp the opportunity to reverse their most cherished principles of femininity. They can forge a story without romance and marriage at the center, can take advantage of independence, a secure income, and nurturing friends. I see parallels between my life and Edith Wharton's. She kept her passion for men under control, as I have. We both chose men that didn't hinder our ability to write, yet we allowed ourselves love and sex. Edith took calculated risk and used the experience with Fullerton in her writing to stimulate her imagination, while going on to create a good life with close friends, traveling, writing, feeding refugees during the First World War, for which she received a medal from the French government, and creating beautiful gardens. I have had a full, productive life as well. It is in Wharton's autobiography that I come across a vision of sustainable living, even into old age. I love this quote.
Yeah, I have it right here.
In spite of illness, in spite even of the arch enemy's sorrow, one can remain alive long past the usual date of disintegration if one is unafraid of change, insatiable in intellectual curiosity, interested in big things, and happy in small ways.
Yeah, I had it. I couldn't because it wasn't my book, but I was ready to, because it was the best of the whole text about how she felt. And I think it's true. If you lose the curiosity, that means you lose the set for life. And that is not. I want to, before we finish, I want to talk a little bit about the cultural shock, because even being an American, you suffer a cultural shock, and imagine mine. And also the integration. You speak a lot about integration and that you didn't feel, after all, integrated. And I wonder about that, because as you mentioned in the book, you met many interesting people from different places, different gender, race, and ages. And so in that department, you were very well taken care. And you have nice classmate too in your course and professor. So why, I would like to know, why did you feel that you were not integrated? What was missing? Something in the British or London society, or you didn't want to give all your heart to London because you knew that you have to come back to the state? What was it?
It's probably complicated. What I realized was, no matter how hard I tried, and I tried.
You tried.
I did volunteer work.
Yes.
I joined the local senior, you know, aerobics class. I volunteered.
And you have friend. You have Tony, who was your beloved friend. So and where you live. So it's not that you are right there and nobody was for you. I mean,
I think what I realized was that it was a lot of my ideas of England were kind of imaginary. I still love London,
of course,
but I think I got very tired, and I came to be missing my son and my grandson and my
daughter-in-law. Yeah, but this is our one thing. But what does that have to do with the integration? I think the integration is not coming only from your side, it's coming from the other side. So what was missing in that society at that time that you felt that you couldn't integrate completely, is instead of all the things that you were doing, all the volunteer, all the classes, all the walking, all the research, what was missing?
I think what was missing was roots.
Your family? This is what
my
you
family,
think?
But roots, but roots. a cultural sense that called me back to being American. And it was also maybe a picturesque idea of America, you know, but I wanted a home, I wanted a house, I wanted a yard. I didn't want to live in a city. I wanted a fireplace, maybe a dog, you know.
Sure, all the things that you have now.
And I wanted a grandson. And when you know that you're in a place and it may be for a certain amount of time, no matter how culturally congruent it is, no matter how much it appeals to your imagination, nevertheless, it's not necessarily home. That whole issue.
Yeah, but that is, in my opinion, something that is hard to understand, because I relate to your situation because I am in a place where I live 20 years, it's true, but it's also a new place because it's the first time that I am living in Portland. But still, I feel that there is an integration, because all the things that I am doing, like you did. So I know that perhaps the difference, but you have been in London before the trip. You went when you were younger, so you have some history too. But nevertheless, you couldn't cross that you felt the cultural shock or loneliness, or maybe the fact that your mother was very sick.
There were lots of things calling me back.
Yes.
And there were lots of things calling me back. Plus, I don't know, being an expatriate, and you know what being an expatriate
is.
Yes.
I live.
Yeah. you start to realize that you don't have always the cultural background, the cultural literacy of your, you know, like I would go out to dinner with my classmates, and they would talk about people I'd never even heard of and make jokes, and I couldn't fathom those jokes.
But
and
also generation too. It's nothing to do with culture. It's because probably you were from other generation. These people were maybe younger than we are. And so this is a generation gap, nothing to do with culture. It happened to me all the time. Every time I work with younger people and they start mentioning so and so and so. That is one of the things that I love your book, because I knew what you were talking about. And music and painting and writer and everything. And I felt that many times, and I feel, well, no, this is new generation. I don't listen their music. I don't read their book. And they feel the same with me. So maybe that happened also.
Well, I was in school with mature students.
So. Also, but also younger.
Yeah, well, the younger ones were all around. I've never had much desire to relate to really young people.
Okay.
So, I mean, what I've enjoyed about my last year in Portland, I moved from this house that I wanted so much into the South Waterfront because I wanted something different. We want different things at different times.
That's true.
And now I am just happy as can be because I'm surrounded by kind of interesting people. It's a slightly urban edge. I'm in a water aerobics class with wonderful, great, smart people. Yes. So I think what we need at different times in our lives is different things.
I agree. You know? I agree. But we have to remember Wharton's sentence. Doesn't mean that we are not curious anymore. Doesn't mean that we gave up the interesting thing that life still has to offer to us and we have to offer to others.
I think, and I was remembering the other day when I was talking to somebody, that a definition of happiness is being three things. One is people to love, and two is interesting things to do on a daily basis, meaningful things, which writing does, and something to look forward to. And so I'm in that wonderful position of having all three.
Yeah, I think to have a project is one of the first things. If you don't have a reason to get up every day, and if you get up to a job that you don't like and you don't feel appreciated, you are in the wrong place. So you have to say bye-bye.
I'm really lucky because it's so hard for people to make a living with writing. And
it's
unbelievably hard. And my heart goes out to younger people who have to deal with that reality. I'm retired, so I can focus on the two things that I need to be focused on. And one is wellness, because it's like chronic responses to wellness issues. And the other thing is writing.
Yeah.
And I am blessed because I've reached this point in life where I can do this.
Yeah, I agree. I think you have the freedom because you work so hard and you have your retirement plan, another thing probably. And so you are in charge of your time. And that is freedom.
And the challenges are different. I don't know what I was trying to prove or do it in London. I mean, I do know because I wrote this book about it. But my challenges now are different. My challenges are keeping well and then also understanding my writing and writing. And what I'm tremendously excited about is next year I have a book about a historical serial killer coming out. But right now I'm working on a book about Nazi book burning. And what I'm doing is going back to that academic specialty.
Yeah.
And combining it with all these new writing skills. And I want to write a book that will take that, what happened, and sort of illuminate it for the intelligent reader. Not the academic. I'm not notching any academic bedposts. I just want to tell the stories of the people involved in the Nazi book burning and what it really means. And in a way, it's sort of an act of resistance, too, because I am really, really sick about what's going on. And so it's I can't go and protest easily because...
But this is your way.
This is my way.
Glad.
So this is an act of resistance that happens to be totally congruent with something that brings me joy.
Of course. The perfect combination, because it comes from your passion and your soul and your principle.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this is what we need. People using those three elements to give the message to everybody. So this way we can change the situation.
It's a response that makes
and as
me
a
feel,
writer, you have the responsibility. Yeah. At least I see it. I see it myself also.
Yeah. And it's a wholehearted response. And it makes me feel very much like I'm right where I should be doing what I should be doing. And maybe that goes back to London. It ultimately came down to the fact that I didn't have that sense of after the 2 years were up.
Yes.
That this was a wholehearted life. You know, I was tired and I wanted something different.
Yeah. You know what was my interpretation? Because I am very close to you in many of the experience. And my interpretation was that first was a lot of different event, your mother aging and the wishes that you wanted, the family, your son, that was a big part, let's say 50%. But the other 50% is that you already did what you wanted to do. That was, you accomplished that, your dream. That was to live in London for a certain amount of year and to take that class and to write the book. So one moment you thought, I accomplished. Why I am still here? I am living.
I think that definitely enters into it, you know. Now, I still go back to London.
Of course. I
look upon the experiences I had in London as kind of compost for my writing.
Sure.
Not just this book, but all my writing.
London is in your heart.
It's in my heart.
And it will be always there. And all the wonderful experience, because you had many wonderful experiences. And this is when people ask me, when are you going back to my home country? And I said, when I get tired of Portland.
Good answer.
Probably in that moment, I will say, I will feel that I got the best that I could. There's nothing else here for me. And then, I will move to Spain that I am thinking about it, or something else. And because I know, like you discover, that is a period in our life. We are not gypsy. We are discovering ourselves and other aspects of the world. And this is what you did. And when you look London from within, from different aspect, you thought, Okay, what else is next? Nothing. I am losing my son. I am losing whatever I have. I need to go back.
Yeah. I think, you know, we're getting close to concluding, but I think I would urge anybody, if they can, to take risks.
I agree.
Because if you don't take risks and make those changes, you don't know what's around the corner.
Yeah, and you also lose the chance for growing more. Okay, where we can find the book? Let's promote the book now.
Okay, you can find the book at bookstores like Annie Bloom's,
yeah,
which is a fabulous bookstore.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be giving a talk at Broadway Books next month with Judith Barrington.
Yeah.
We're going to do it.
Oh, Judith, who was here last time.
We're going to do an in conversation about our two memoirs. You can get it on Amazon.
Yeah.
And
also the printer where
Barnes
you print.
Barnes & Noble.
Because I look, I look at you on the internet, and they were all the book there, all your book.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Oh, I wouldn't recommend anybody try the academics.
No, I think they should start with this one. That is a very, very, very nice, very well written, and it give you a whole perspective and a little bit of intimate perspective about who you were or who you are, and the life in London, and mainly the adventure.
And
I cannot agree more. I have done it myself.
And for those who love to read, it's like a reader took herself to London. What better city to go to if you love books and reading?
Yeah. Bueno, and if you have a good English. Okay, this is what it is. We came to our bye-bye, and next week is going to be March, Friday 13. We are going to celebrate Women International Day. So we have a couple of women that we will be talking about accomplishment. Thank you very much. I do appreciate and look for this book. And if you have comment, you can write to me to the radio and we can read it and we can keep talking about this wonderful book.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.